When we make those kind of friendships, and then maybe many years go by, and bingo, we cross tracks again. You know, it's if our separation was of such short duration that it really didn't count, and we're instantly caught up into a new love, not a new one, but the same one, but a new experience with an old friend. That's one of the reasons that I'm grateful to be here today, and one of the pleasant memories I have about this group. Another is about 18 years ago, the people in Midland, some of the A's in Midland, decided they wanted a nice clubhouse when they had no conception or idea about how to go about doing it, getting one. And we wrote General Service Headquarters and asked them how we might wind up renting or whatever method of having clubhouse facilities that were nicer than the ones that we had been experiencing. And we got letters back from General Service with packets of literature and about how to go about doing it, and that didn't seem to solve our problem. And we heard about the suburban group here in Austin and what they had done. This club was, how old is this clubhouse? 20 years old? Where's Cecil? He's the only one. This clubhouse is 13 years old? Well, hey, that's right. You all came to me. With all the modesty that I can muster, you have us to thank for your clubhouse. You know, I guess about the period of time that you all built this clubhouse, if I'd have been making an AA talk and said that, I'd have poured gasoline on myself, struck a match, and dived off the podium. And at 10:30 in the morning, I could care less. Yeah. Well, now some of you are going through an act, and it really isn't that funny. Cecil, have one of your minions bring me a glass of water, will you? That frankly dried me up. Well, seemed like I had two or three things that were going to be tied into that. I've never seen one fellow as tickled about anything in my life. Oh, I had another experience last night here in Austin. I ate part of my teeth. Thank you. I was good. You bet. Thank you. Well, when I did that, I ate a cracker, see? And all of a sudden, I discovered that I'd eaten part of my teeth. One of the girls at the table said, "Do you think there's any hope of recovery?" And I said, "Not at the dinner table." Well, I'll just sum it all up by saying I'm glad to be here. Thank you. I'll need that too. You bet. Thank you. Let me tell you about, because he's here today, and I don't ever remember telling this before the night meeting. some of the unbelievable benefits that accrue. When we've been around a little while and we've tacked on a bit of sobriety one day at a time. Marceline mentioned when she was talking last night about the time we lost our daughter and our oldest daughter that died of cancer. And we'd been in Mexico. Marceline had been with her for 3 months in Mexico, and I'd been down there with her a month or 6 weeks. And she passed away, and Marceline told you that as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we were able to handle this situation as well as it is possible to handle those types of situations. But sometimes when we're just desperate, you know, our prayers or our wishes, rather than prayers maybe, are answered in ways that just blow my mind. And I have had an ongoing experience of this nature since I've been coming to AA, different things. But when I saw Jack Clugger this morning, I was reminded of this, and I want to share it with you. We had finally made our way back to San Diego from Mexico under the most adverse of all possible conditions that have to do with the death in Mexico. And it's a hard thing to experience. Getting your loved one that's just passed away out of there is, you know, nearly impossible. But we were at the airport, and sitting in the coffee shop, one of our twin daughters and Marceline. And on three or four occasions that day, I had said to myself, God Almighty, I wish I could see an AA. You know, if I could just have seen someone, you know, I know I would have felt better. And within seconds, Mary, after a thought came to my mind once more, and we're all three of us sitting silently at a table. And I said, God, I just really need to see an AA. And I looked to my left, not any farther than from here to that clock. And there sat Jack Clayton in the airport in San Diego, California. And I imagine if he and I lived 5,000 more years, that the chances would be remote. That unless it were a pre-planned event, that our paths would never cross at the exact period that set that time in San Diego, California, at the airport, in a certain area of a coffee shop. And things of this nature. Oh, incidentally, Marceline needed some cheering up too. You would not believe what he had on. A wide tie with an enormous butterfly on it. So that was his gift to the Alamo. And his presence was my gift. And I'll just always love Jack special because you were there. Okay. Ooh-wee. Are there as many as three people here today who have not heard me tell about me taking my first drink? You haven't? There's one. Two. Way back there in the back. Thank you. I know I went for many, many years and grew quite sophisticated in making AA talks. And quit telling about how it used to be. And I had some philosophizing to do. And maybe kind of had it wrapped up to where if you listen carefully, you could take what I said as a set of instructions. And if you followed them, you'd become a millionaire. And your wife would straighten up, you know, and everything would be just right. But for the last few years, I've determined that it's better to go back the way it says do it in the book. When I was a little kid, the same as I've heard so many people say, I was really uncomfortable most of the time. I had a bad run-in with authority and didn't seem to make it, you know, with parental control and authority or others' authority. And I stayed tense, nervous, hung up about something, and uncomfortable. It's about the best way I can describe my boyhood. And a lot of things happened, and in each one of the things that come to my mind or memory that have to do with my early childhood, the same inner anxiety and loneliness and feeling of discomfort that I experienced then truly was not much different than it was 20, 30 years later when I was drinking and got myself in bad trouble. About the only difference that I could tell is there was more things to be guilty about, and I had a hangover to accompany that original and early feeling. But the feeling was truly not much different. I lived with a small modicum of fear that went about with me, and I wasn't particularly afraid of people, and I wasn't particularly afraid of authority. I was only afraid of the hassle that my conduct, you know, would set about. And I seemed to be always in conflict with another person or a group of people, and I'm just terribly uncomfortable. But when I was 16, is when the, hello, Bob. When I was 16 years old, I had the experience of having my first drink. And then, of course, things changed. But let me tell you about it, because I still think it's a keen old deal to tell about my first drink. I had never had a date, and I had, of course, not had a drink of alcohol at that time. And my brother left town and let me borrow his little car, and I had $5. So I instantly gained a friend, and he was much older than I, when he knew that I had a car and $5. And he suggested that we double date. And he went through the procedure of asking me, was I going steady, you know, and I said, well, not at this time. And he said, what do you do, just go with one and another? And I said, that's it. But anyway, it, you know, rather quickly came about that he would have to get me a date. And he got me, this guy's about 22 or 3 years old, and he got me a date with his date's older friend. And we sat about for a big time on the town. The first thing that they started talking about was going and getting a drink. And I was already so terribly uncomfortable that, you know, I cannot relate to another human how paralyzed with fear I was about my first date. I had anticipated and dreamed of, thought about dating and girls for a long period of time. And I knew that probably someday I would do it, you know. But I sure wasn't prepared when the time came. And I had had all kinds of dreams and thoughts and so forth about girls. But this particular time was the time to act. Well, they started talking about getting something to drink, and I finally heard something that I could, you know, snap to. So I put that old car in low gear and went whizzing off down to Doc Daniels' drugstore. And that wasn't the place that they intended to get a drink at all. It was out at the bootleggers, you know. And that embarrassed me to death, you know, about when people started talking about drinking, that I headed off to the wrong place. You know, and I would have given anything had I been able just to, you know, if I'd have known where the bootlegger lived, so I could have, with a lot of nonchalance, driven up to the bootlegger's house like I'd been there 15 or 20 times before. But anyway, we bought a couple of pints with my money, I might add. And this is the part that really had, you know, made a total change on the balance of my life. When they insisted that I drink first. And I guess this is some type of common courtesy that's always due the guy that springs for the drinks. And I'm telling the gospel truth. I didn't know whether to drink one-fourth of it. There were 4 of us in the car, you know. I didn't know if each of us got 8 drinks out of it apiece. I had no conception of what it tastes like. I had no idea of how much or what constituted a drink. And they just insisted that I drink first. And I kept saying, no, oh, no, you know, so I could watch. anyway, I finally threw all caution to the wind and tilted that bottle up and took two or three big swallows out of it. And it went down remarkably easy. There was no, you know, much of anything happened. And when I found out that it wasn't nearly as hard to do as I had dreamt maybe that it would be, then after a brief period of conversation, they suggested we have another drink. And with not near the reluctance that I first had, I agreed to go ahead and drink first again, and I took another big belt. And this happened two or three times. And then is when I heard my first voice that I didn't recognize. You know, and I heard this voice come right out and say, "Hey, let's all have another drink." And to my amazement, I found it was me talking. And that truly is about all I remember about the first night. There are a number of people here. Thank goodness there's more of you young ones, though, than there is those old ones. But there is several people here that will remember a Model A Ford coupe. Literally, the seat was very little wider than this, you know, and it had a gear shift in the middle. And I love to tell this part. It was so tiny that this girl had to sit in his lap. And this big old girl I was with was mashed up against me. And I've told this before, but it's the God's truth. I felt like it was molten fire pouring down my side. I have never felt anything that hot before in my life. God, man. And it's so crowded in one of those little old cars. It had a big old steering wheel made out of wood, and it's about that big round. And it, you know, it didn't have power steering. And you really tugged to turn that thing. And I turned my first corner. I turned right all that. God, I didn't, you know, I had no idea they felt like that. Later on, that, you know, I was embarrassed to be, you know, touching her any place. And then, you know, no automatic shift, you got a gear shift. It requires all kind of maneuvering to, and I finally turned right and shifted gears all night long. And just had a marvelous time. You know, my very first drinking experience turned out just like all the rest of them. Man, I got in trouble. I got caught. I got sick. You know? And I was embarrassed and ashamed. Hated all the circumstances. Hated the people that caught me. Didn't know what to say. Finally told the only truth that I've ever known until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When they kept on asking me why I'd done it, I said I didn't know. You know, I finally said I don't know so many times that they, in their conferences, and I might add, when they get together, buddy, you better watch out. You coming out on the losing end. And when they would get together and call me in for a conference, the introductory remarks were always the same. They'd say, "Bob, why do you do it?" And I would continue to say with all the truth that I had, "I don't know." One time, and many, many years later, toward the end, within 5 or 10 years of the end, at a gathering of that sort, they asked the same question, "Why did you do it?" And again, I told the truth and said, "I don't know." And one retort was the fact that if I wasn't such a smart aleck, they might be able to help me if I would only cooperate and tell them why I had done it. Well, it became obvious to me, even in my condition, that, you know, the truth wasn't going to be satisfactory for me under those conditions, so I started making up some real tales about why I did it. And, you know, I really think they liked the tall tales better than they did the truth, because there was some, regardless of whether they could go along with them or not, there was some reason to a lie. But the truth had no reason for them because of their lack of understanding. And that, you know, that's just the way I was for a long, long, many, many years. Marceline and I got married, and oh gosh, I was so desperately in love. And, you know, that should have changed my life. And we had not been married long at all. And incidentally, you know, Marceline's dad, you know, bad drunk she was talking about last night. First time I got in jail after she and I were married, I was with him. You know, we didn't, you know, get that started in real good shape either. But I just didn't seem to be able to catch on to this business of being a husband and then a little later on a daddy and act with the responsibility that I think so many other young men seem to be born with. I don't know where they got it, how it came about. But I know that not one time do I ever remember from the time I was a little bitty boy up till this moment in time. You know, I always wish I hadn't done it. And I have never, to my knowledge, done a bad thing to other people that I planned and set out to do it. My badness comes on me quite suddenly. And I really don't plan to wind up like I've always wound up. I didn't set out to be an alcoholic. My Lord, you know, that was the last thing in the world that I would have set out to do, is to be an alcoholic. When I'd had my first drink and this feeling of wonderment came over me and I felt at peace for the first time that I'd ever remembered within myself and with the world at large, you know, I wasn't setting out to be an alcoholic and wind up in bad, bad trouble in later years. Man, I was setting out to feel good, to feel comfortable, and to get with it, and to be the things that I had secretly admired in other people and had always wanted to be myself. And it seemed as if a little alcohol afforded me the opportunity of a start in that direction. Now, that's you see, I didn't set out to be anything other than that. I didn't plan it. And in most of the things that I've experienced in my life, when they've come upon me and I've found that this is what I really am, I never planned it that way. And I know that basically, down deep, that I'm not a bad person. I think basically I'm a very fine and good person. And it just keeps trying to get outside and I stand between it, you know, and it's complete exposure. When Marceline and I got married, my problem, of course, wasn't nearly as acute as it was in later years. But a pattern had already developed. We got married quite young. If the money lasted, or the alcohol lasted, or the circumstances were such that I could exercise control, I always wound up drunk. God, I have no idea how many times I've been drunk in my life. I don't ever remember being tacked, you know. There was a fleeting moment with every day that I drank, that there was a fleeting moment in time that I kept trying to recapture. You know, I term my alcoholism and liken it to a marshmallow, toasted marshmallows. You know, when you're toasting marshmallows and you got them on a stick or a coat hanger or something and put them over the fire, next time you toast marshmallows, remember this. The moment that a marshmallow is perfect, not black, but brown, toasted and is exactly right, if you wait until it gets just right to pull it out of the fire, it's too late. It'll catch on fire every time. every time that you try to, when a marshmallow gets just right, you can't jerk it back over the coals fast enough to keep it from bursting into flame and making a cinder. And man, that's the way my drinking was. You know, I had a little inner marshmallow that I wanted to get just right, and I never could remember which drink it was that my marshmallow got fixed. I always took the one that burned it up, you know. And I kept burning marshmallows up, you know, forever, it seemed like. Just the little cinders. And I just never could experience that one drink in time that mellow feeling and that good feeling. The feeling that let me be what I really wanted to be, you know. And I couldn't maintain it. Hell, sometimes I'd think it'd happen on the sixth drink, you know. And God, I'd just gulp five down so that I could leisurely drink on that sixth one and wait for this magic to come about. And then I think, hell, that ain't it. And I think I couldn't remember from one day to the next what drink it was that made me feel so good. Now, I know that when I first started drinking, that period of time that I felt so good, you know, had a little length to it. But God Almighty, man, the last 2 or 3 years I drank, I scooted through that time frame, you know, quicker than a bolt of lightning. You know, it was gone. I just never did attain it again. You know, I kept on drinking and kept on drinking. And as God is my maker, I was not aware of what I was becoming. I didn't know what road I was walking down. And I didn't know how to change or be different than what I was, because I kept looking for this magic moment in time that I could live all day long or a week long and everything be just right. And I remember that years ago that I heard Jack Odom from San Antonio say something that has impressed me as much as anything I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "The chains that bind us are never felt until it's too late to break them." And, you know, slowly but surely, I was becoming ensnared in the illness called alcoholism. And I was totally unaware of the experience that had come upon me. I had no idea. I knew that as time went by, you know, that I was getting into more trouble. But I continued to associate my problem with those people or those bankers or things external to myself. And there seemed to be no solving them. The thing that has to do with this business about the chains that bind you, that are too late to break them. First off, I think there's two invisible lines that we experience or cross over into alcoholism. There's the one that we hear about so much, the invisible line that separates social from pathological drinking. And I really don't know. I guess I passed over that one quite soon. But I think there's another line. And this line, it's a little hard for me to explain because I don't know that much about it. But it's a line that some of us who are members of this fellowship have crossed. And once we get on the far side of the line, it's as if we recognize the problem and have lost all power to do something about it. You see, I had been told for so many, many years that if I'd stop drinking, that things would be better, and the same old thing that all of y'all heard. And I was the last one to want to stop drinking, and I continue to drink. But one day, in a moment of truth, I finally came to the recognition that my problems and drinking were directly tied together. Directly tied together. And I determined to do something about it. I said, if that's all it takes, I'll stop drinking. And I had lost any power that I had ever had in the control of alcohol. And I could not stop drinking. And that was about the last 2 or 3 years that I drank. And it was the most miserable experience that I have ever known or can remember. You know, I finally came to hate every drink that I took. I despised the people that I bought it from. I didn't like others around me who drank. The only reason I ever drank with another person is because I could drink freely. That's the only reason. I did a lot of my drinking at home, and certainly most of it in some old flea bag motel someplace. And all I looked for was the oblivion that too much alcohol brought. and I could not quit being what I had become. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to change and be different. I don't believe that our fellowship has ever had one person who was more desirous of being something different than he had become than I. And I gave it my best shot. Anything that I knew to do, I tried to do in order to be different than the way I was. And I, by God, I couldn't change. And I think that that's a line that hopefully everyone who's alcoholic doesn't have to cross over. It's total, total misery. You know, I'm one of the ones that also know that there has to be a power greater than myself. No doubt there is a power. You see, I gave it my very best shot to be something different than what I had become. And Marceline and our three daughters, with everything at their command, supported by their love, wanted me to be different than what I had become, and they couldn't change me. My parents, my brothers, my close friends wanted me to be something different than what I had become, and they too, with everything at their command and their support, wanted to help me to a change so I could be different. And they totally failed. And there was some cops and some of those kind of people who insisted that I become different, you know. And boy, I just kept on being just the way I was. And they too failed. And some while later, in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really understood what the second step of our program really meant. You know, just really, really understood that there is a power that can restore us to its sanity and to a sane and normal way of life. You know, I don't ever again need proof of its being when not only I, but everyone whom I know gave me their best shot and we all failed. And then I came to AA, and with no apparent effort, no great deal, the change started happening. I want to tell you how I happened to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been away for several weeks. I have no idea how long, of course, laid up drunk all the time. And as Marceline told you last night, they scooped me up and took me to the farm. And incidentally, I had a unique experience there. My mother and father, my dad, if he were living, would be 98 years old his next birthday. And mother's still living and still going to every AA convention that Marceline and I'll take her to. That, you know, she just loves the people in AA. And thank you, and God bless each and every one of you.